Travel presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with guitarist Jeff Skunk Baxter. In our conversation, Jeff tells us about his role in the upcoming Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, which he does fairly often. Jeff tells us about his youth growing up in Mexico City and how he ended up playing guitar and eventually starting a surf band with Abe Labriole. And Jeff describes his early influences, which are all very eclectic. And Jeff talks about his move from Mexico to Connecticut and then to New York City, working at Jimmy's Music and then the Dan Armstrong Repair Shop, and working on innovations with Bill Lawrence. Jeff describes the guitarists he ran into while working in New York City: Sam Brown, Eddie Deal, Danny Korchmar, and Les Paul, just to name a few. And Jeff talks about his move to Boston to attend Boston University and working with David Schechter and studying the pedal steel. Jeff tells us about his love of muscle cars and a few of the cars he's had throughout the years. And Jeff discusses a few of his bands, Steely Dan and the Doobie Brothers, and he talks about his session work and why he preferred to sit while playing live. Jeff talks about his love of eclectic guitars and what his collection looks like now, and he talks about the work he's done for Roland, Gibson, and Fender. Jeff discusses his work for the government, his hand in bringing rock and roll music to Russia, and his thoughts on new technologies and the ones used during World War II, and talks a little bit about Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for 0 Point. Jeff tells us about being an avid reader of technical journals and guitar magazines, and he talks about plans for his second solo album. To find out more about Jeff, you can go to his website, jeffskunkbaxter.com. That's JeffSkunkBaxter.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my friend Jeff.
Hey there, Jeff.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's an honor to meet you.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Albeit in a virtual world, but it's an honor to meet you for sure.
Pleasure's mine.
You're doing the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp coming up pretty soon?
Yeah, I've done a few of them, and they're a lot of fun. It's always a good chance to hang out with friends.
Sure. Do you actually teach, or are you mentoring most of the part, or just telling stories?
Mostly playing with the different individuals. I have not done much teaching. And I haven't really done a mentoring thing for quite a while. That's a little more time than I have.
Sure.
Sure. Fun though.
Yes, of course. As a youth, you were in Mexico City. You grew up in Mexico City, is that correct?
Yes.
How did that happen? Were your parents in government?
No, my dad was an advertising executive. Oh. I don't know if you ever saw Mad Men.
Sure.
That was my dad.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, he was senior executive vice president of J. Walter Thompson.
Oh, wow.
Which at the time was the biggest advertising agency in the world. So, Mexico was, it was a lot of fun.
Sure.
And I had a great little surf band with Abraham Laborio.
And what was Abe doing in Mexico?
He grew up there.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. His parents weren't working in the same place your parents were they?
No. He was actually living in, I think he grew up in Mexico as well.
Okay. All right. What brought you to guitar initially?
On my 9th birthday, my parents bought me a guitar.
Okay.
And it pissed me off because I wanted a bicycle. And I'd already been taking piano lessons for years, so I just kind of I just hung it on the wall.
Okay.
And a few months later, a friend of mine who lived in the same apartment complex, a guy named Kurt Bundy, asked me he noticed the guitar on the wall. I said, if I show you some chords, that would give me somebody to play with. I went, yeah, okay, I'll give it a try. And I don't know, I just kind of fell in love.
Was it a nylon string?
No, it was had steel strings. It was a cheap guitar.
Okay.
And it didn't play all that great, but I started to modify it as best I could.
Sure.
All the way back then. And it was okay. It got me started.
Yeah. Did you ever get a bike?
No.
You didn't ever got a bike?
Never got a bicycle.
What was Mexico City like for a kid back then?
It's fantastic. at the time, there wasn't a lot of violence.
Uh-huh.
Everybody got along. You could literally get anywhere you wanted to in Mexico City, either for a 1 peso. You could take what they called the pesero, which was a taxi that would go all the way from my neighborhood all the way to downtown.
Okay.
Or as you got to know the guys who drove the milk trucks and water trucks to make deliveries,
uh-huh,
you just jump on that and you knew their routes and you could ride with them.
That's great. Did you go to school in Mexican schools?
I went to the American school there for a couple of years. And they taught half a day in English and half a day in Spanish.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after that, my dad wanted me to get a better education, so they sent me to the British Embassy School.
Okay.
Green Gates, yeah. Academy, yeah.
Wow. What was your dad doing in Mexico City? I mean, I knew he worked for an advertising agency, but like, why Mexico City of all places?
Well, he was running all of J. Walter Thompson's Latin American business. Sort of centralized in Mexico City.
Okay. Did he speak fluent Spanish?
No.
No?
No. No.
Wow. And did you learn how to speak fluent Spanish?
Yes.
Oh, right on.
Well, again, they throw you right, you know, you throw your feet first, and between half a day in school in Spanish, playing Little League and Pony League baseball.
Yeah.
Playing with a lot of Mexican musicians and rock and roll bands.
Yeah.
Just generally immersing yourself in it.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Yep. Was baseball a big thing down there?
Huge.
Yeah.
Baseball was to poverty-stricken Mexican kids what football and basketball was to African-American kids in the United States. It was a possible pathway to success.
Sure, sure.
So you got 12-year-old kids throwing a baseball at 85 miles an hour, you know. They're trying so hard.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was great baseball.
Yeah, that's great. When you did get interested in guitar, when you got interested, what brought you there?
Well, there were a few influences, obviously, or not obviously, but the Ventures were a big influence.
Sure.
And I was very lucky years later to get to know them, play with them, produce records for them.
Yeah.
So it kind of came full circle. Howard Roberts was a big influence. I listened to both his first albums.
Okay.
Basically learned them note for note.
Yeah.
And there were other guitar players like Billy Muir, Charlie Christian.
Oh, of course.
And Django Reinhardt.
Yeah.
Which were, because Mexico was a very eclectic place as far as music was concerned.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of influences.
Yeah. Were you mostly listening to instrumental guitar work? I mean, the Ventures, obviously, but...
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I was listening to American rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
But because I had a real fondness for guys like Wes Montgomery and Les Paul, Howard Roberts, and again, Charlie Christian, Django Reinhardt, Kenny Burrell, Kenny Bunn, guys like that, I listened to a lot of guitar instrumentals.
Sure, sure. Were you in Mexico when the Beatles hit?
Yes.
And did they get the Ed Sullivan Show? Did you have TV and all that?
Well, we had TV. We didn't have a lot of American shows.
Uh-huh.
But I could watch TV when I was in boarding school in Connecticut.
Okay.
And I could watch the Lawrence Welk Show in Mexico City. So I could watch Thumbs Carlisle and Speedy West and all those guys. So, that was a treat.
Yeah, for sure. And so you went to boarding school in Connecticut. How'd you end up in New York City?
My parents moved back to the United States.
Okay.
And my dad, they promoted him headquarters in J. Weldon Thompson headquarters.
Okay.
In New York, and that's how I got there.
Okay. And how old were you when you moved to New York City?
Around 16, something like that.
And what was New York City like? I mean, had you been to New York City before that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you had, okay.
Because I've been working in
a culture shock, a complete culture shock?
No, and there were times when instead of going all the way back to Mexico City for like Christmas vacation or Easter, which was short,
yeah,
I would stay with friends in New York City.
Okay.
And work in the music stores in the daytime, mostly Jimmy's Music Store.
Uh-huh.
And then Dan Armstrong's shop.
Yeah.
And then play clubs at night.
Yeah. And was Dan Armstrong's shop, was it mostly a repair shop, or was it actually a full-on music store?
Oh, no, it wasn't a full-on music store. We sold guitars.
Uh-huh.
But it was repair and customizing. I mean, we would do a lot of, you would call it custom work.
Yeah.
In the same way as you might go out and buy a Chevy Bel Air with a 327 mouse in it, the 12 block.
Yeah.
Then go down to the local parts store and start putting an Idlebrock high rise tarantula manifold on it.
Yeah.
Start putting, hooker headers on it.
Yeah.
Disky cams. Yeah. We did that for guitars.
Okay. So switching out pickups, putting on different necks.
Yeah. Rewiring electronics to do different things.
Okay.
I worked a lot with Bill Lawrence.
Yeah.
Bill was a friend of Dan's and mine.
Okay.
And did a lot of experimentation.
Uh-huh. Did you help him come up with the Blade pickups?
No.
No.
What I did come up with was the idea of tapping coils in a humbucking pickup.
Oh, right on.
And then the idea of tapping single coil pickups at different places in the wiring, in the winding, to get different impedances. So you could have one pickup that might have, a 7K, 12K, 15K. So you got a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah. And who are the people that were coming in to get this hot rod stuff done to their guitars?
Wow, all kinds of folks. Mike Bloomfield, Frank Zappa, Cooch, Danny Korchmar.
Sure.
Who a couple of years ago called me. I've stayed in touch with Danny since we were kids.
Okay.
And he said, you remember that Telecaster you did for me? We were working at Danny's back in 64. I went, yeah, I do. One with a black pickguard and was missing a couple screws. Said, yeah, well, I took it to Fender and they screwed it up.
Oh,
can you take it back to what you did? And I said, I think I can, because I still have boxes of old potentiometers, cloth insulation wire, central lab switches.
Yeah.
From in the box.
Yeah.
From back in the day. Because later on, when Dave Schechter and I created a guitar customizing and repair shop in Boston, we had a huge inventory of stuff, and I kept a lot of it. Just, I don't know, figuring that since I guaranteed anything I did for life, people would come back, and they do.
Yeah, evidently. And do you have a full-on shop in your garage currently, or...?
I have a workbench.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a miniature version of what I had at Dan's place.
Okay. All right. And had you been tinkering, through all the bands, through all the music you've done, have you been tinkering on guitars this whole time?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Cool.
Oh, yeah.
Very good.
Doing work for Gibson, doing work for Fender.
Wow.
Kelly Guitars. A number of different folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And just notable guitarists that you met while you were in New York City. Anybody that would come to mind?
Well, everybody was anybody would come into Dan's shop.
Uh-huh.
That's when I first met Les Paul.
Oh, wow.
And we became friends.
Sure.
Until he passed away.
Yeah.
A couple of fearsome guitar players used to hang out there all the time. Eddie Deal, probably got to be, if not the finest, one of the top five bebop guitar players I ever heard in my life.
Okay.
Sam Brown.
Uh-huh.
And Danny was no slouch as a player.
Okay.
So there was a lot going on up there.
Yeah.
All the time.
Okay, good, good. And what about at Jimmy's? Did you meet people there?
Yeah, different people would come in from different bands. I remember a gentleman from the Blues Magoos came in one time. I helped him with one of his guitars.
Uh-huh.
Because I was starting to do guitar repair when I was working at Jimmy's.
Okay.
And that's why Dan Armstrong came over to Jimmy's, because there weren't a lot of guitars coming out of Jimmy's to his shop to be repaired.
Uh-huh.
So Dan said, how much are they paying you? I went, minimum wage, $1.25 an hour, you know? And he said, well, I'll pay you $5 an hour.
Wow.
Come work for me. I went, oh, yeah. That was big money in those days.
Oh, of course, of course. Of course. And so this would be like the late 60s when this is happening?
Mid-60s.
Mid-60s, okay. Very good. Did you ever work for Manny's across the street?
No, but I did a lot of guitar repair at Manny's.
Okay.
From Manny's at Dan's place. And Henry Goldrick he just started looking out for me.
Okay.
Because, you know, I was living in Mexico.
Sure.
And I didn't really have a home, you know, other than staying with friends.
Yeah.
Sometimes at the corporate apartments in my dad's company.
Okay.
But he took a liking to me.
Uh-huh.
And just looked out for me.
Yeah. Did your parents give you a choice of if you wanted to stay in New York or if you wanted to go to live in Mexico?
Not really, because my dad had to stay in Mexico until the opportunity arose. And I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, I liked playing in the music scene. I was a young kid.
Yeah.
But I'd managed to weasel a cabaret card so I could work in the clubs.
Okay.
And I loved playing in rock bands in Mexico.
Sure. Yeah.
Playing with bands like the Hooligans and people like that. Plus, Doug Messenger, great guitar player.
Uh-huh.
We played a lot together. And Abraham, Boboreal.
Yeah. Did you, anybody from Mexico that you saw when you moved back to New York City, like anybody make that migration beside yourself?
I don't know if I think Doug might have come back, but I hadn't seen him in many, many, many years. It was just really Abraham.
How early on did you meet people like Rick Derringer and Johnny Winter and Edgar?
I think it was fairly early on, because, again, these folks would come into the shop.
Yeah.
It was really the only place that you could go to if you wanted, say you wanted somebody to install a Bixby tremolo on your Telecaster, or you wanted to swap out the capacitors on the tone controls in your guitar. Or,
yep.
Yeah, we were it.
At that time, when you were playing in clubs and stuff, was it always backline? Did they backline back then, or was it people bringing amps and stuff?
Usually brought your own amps.
Really? What were you playing through?
A Fender Vibroverb with a JBL D130.
Okay.
Great amp.
Yeah. Yeah. And not too heavy either.
Well, with the JBL, it certainly was a schlep.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a pretty good upper body because I was working at Jimmy's. I'd be taking, you know, 50 twin reverbs up four flights of stairs in the middle of August.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, you know.
What were you playing for? Did you have like a steady guitar, or were you just going through guitars that were coming through the shop as far as playing in clubs?
I played a Jazzmaster a lot, and it's still one of my favorite guitars.
Yeah.
And I also had bought a Telecaster.
Okay. Wow. And do you ever meet Leo Fender?
Many times.
Okay. Yeah.
We became friends later on when I moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
California.
Okay. All right. And what brought you to Boston?
College.
Okay. You went to Taft? Is that correct? No.
Well, Taft is a prep school in Connecticut.
Okay.
Boston University
Boston
was that.
University.
Yeah, university.
So in the Back Bay.
Yeah, right up there on Upper Mass Ave.
Yeah. Yeah. Any thoughts to go on to Berklee School of Music while you were there, or not so much?
No, because I was playing a lot.
Uh-huh.
And doing some studio work.
Uh-huh.
And playing in interesting venues. I remember one venue, great keyboard player named Jeff Lass came to me and said, "We're putting together a dinner show at Paul's Mall," which was a club in Boston. It was the Jazz Workshop and Paul's Mall. They were both downstairs, mm-hmm. across from each other. And wants you to play guitar and pedal steel. And so I said, "Yeah, what is it?" He said, "Well, it's all Gershwin," which I loved, you know. Yeah. And again, being a classical player, piano player, and, you know, having worked my way through all the Henry Mancini stuff and everything else, I was a big fan of Gershwin.
Sure.
And so situations like that were cropping up everywhere. So I didn't go to Berklee or anything, but I had this immersion in all of that, playing weddings and bar mitzvahs and all that, having stacks of fake books.
Yeah.
So I learned every standard there was.
Okay.
And which was great, because later on, when I would go play with Les at Fat Tuesdays or the Iridium, Les was a very personable guy.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the guitar players that came and played with him sort of lived in the world of the pentatonic scale.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
But he was very gracious.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, he would play the blues. But when I would walk in, he'd go, "All right." So "What do you want to do, Les?" "Well, we'll start off with On Green Dolphin Street."
Oh, wow.
"And then we'll do Take the A Train to Billy Strayer." "Absolutely." "Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered."
Yeah.
"And then we'll do Black Shiny Stockings." And yeah, I knew them all.
Right on.
You know, learning the music and the fake books.
Yeah. When did you become acquainted with the pedal steel guitar?
Literally when I moved to Boston.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you were hearing the pedal steel, but did you know how it operated and everything?
I did, because I'd been repairing them.
Oh, okay.
You know, I didn't know what I was doing in the beginning, but hey, it's mechanical.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a lot of math.
Yeah. And I was fairly comfortable with small block V8 engines. So to me, there wasn't that much difference. You use ignition wrenches to adjust the steel anyway.
Uh-huh.
So there's kind of this commonality.
Okay.
Between cars and pedal steel guitars.
Have you always been a car guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Muscle cars?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you own a muscle car or cars now?
Not anymore. Well, I guess I own a muscle car. I have a 2003 Ford Explorer.
Okay.
With the police interceptor package.
Oh, wow. Right on.
It thinks it's a Crown Vic. Yeah.
That's great. What did you have before? Like, did you ever, were you, you know, the 68 Camaro or were you a Mustang? Was there?
I had a 66 GTO.
Okay.
I had a Bricklin with a big block Ford 351 Cleveland.
Okay. Wow.
A monster car. Awesome.
What about a Pantera?
No, because they were kind of one and the same. I mean, they were not dissimilar.
Yeah.
But when I got to Brooklyn, I swapped the engine out. I put a 351 Cleveland.
Okay.
The C4 transmission.
Uh-huh.
And then I took it down, which is a truck transmission, Ford truck transmission.
Yeah.
Really heavy duty. Changed the rear end to to like a 413. And then had Dick Gulstrand do all the suspension.
Okay.
And it was, that car was glued to the road.
Okay.
And it got up and went. I mean, it was a light car. As a matter of fact, I were a couple of times when I actually dropped a naked small block Ford 302 just in the back and strapped it down for traction. this thing was nuts.
And where were you living when you were driving this? Are you driving it on the, on a racetrack, or are you driving it on the street?
Well, I was driving it on the street, but there were times when I would go out to the racetrack.
Okay.
And there were times when I would go out to Route 15.
This is in Boston.
No, this is in LA.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No car in Boston, didn't need it.
Yeah.
Well, this was LA, driving from that road from LA to Las Vegas.
Yeah, I know which one.
it was like a 17-mile road in Detroit,
And what about cars in Boston? I know you didn't need one, but were you working on them?
No, I spent pretty much all of my time working on guitars.
Okay.
And
how'd you get acquainted with Dave Schechter?
I'm not sure where we met up. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I just remember that we hit it off.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, there's a lot of work.
Yeah.
There's your Wurlitzer's, there's Jack Strom Shop, there's all these different stores that needed guitar repair.
Yeah.
And so there was a guy up at E.O. Wurlitzer that was doing some guitar repair. Uh-huh. Trying to think of his last name. But there was plenty of work. And we were also building guitars.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah. We were a one-stop shop.
How'd you get hooked up with Walter and Donald?
I was in Boston working in a studio called Intermedia Sound.
Okay.
I think it was, the artist was Paul Pina, I think, playing guitar on sessions, working on his record. And Gary Katz was in another studio in the same building.
Okay.
Producing an album by a band called The Bead Game. A great guitar player, John Shelton.
Okay.
Really great. And great drummer, Jimmy Hodder, who eventually came to play with us in Steely Dan.
Okay.
And that's when I met Gary. And I think he asked me to come in and play acoustic on one of the Bead Game songs, because he'd stuck his head in. Said, yeah, we need some acoustic on this.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, I'm doing a project in New York City. And I had been commuting.
Okay.
Back and forth from Boston to New York and, to do sessions down there.
Sure.
And said, I'm doing a project with a lady named Linda Hoover. And there are these two gentlemen that are writing most of the material for it. Would you be willing to come down and work on the project?
Mm-hmm.
And said, sure. Grabbed my guitar, took the train. By that time, I knew, where to rent amplifiers and,
yep,
Carol Music, Central Music.
Uh-huh.
And after we finished the project, Walter and Donald said, we've never really heard anybody play guitar like you do. I said, well, I've never really heard anybody write songs like this. This is fantastic.
Sure.
And so we said, well, maybe someday we ought to think about forming a band. And I moved out to Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And Gary Katz went to Los Angeles to take a job at ABC Dunhill Records, and got Becker and Fagan a publishing deal at ABC Records. And so that's kind of when the pot started to boil.
Yeah, yeah. And when you performed with them, you were always sitting down. And what brought that on?
Well, a couple of things. When I had met Andre Segovia, who came into Dan's shop one day for a guitar repair.
All right.
He actually said something about that, because I think Mike Bloomfield and Frank Zappa and a couple of guys were in the corner of the front room, which was just guitars and amps and, you know, and a sofa and chairs. And they were sort of you know, they're standing up doing some playing. Mr. Segovia was sitting very patiently on the sofa waiting for me to finish his guitar. And I've told this story before, but I gave him his guitar and he sat down. I handed it to him, he sat back down and played the first 64 bars for the Concerto de Aranjuez by Rodrigo. And something about that man was absolute magic, supernatural. And after he was satisfied with the instrument, and he turned in Spanish and said, "Please tell these gentlemen that you don't hang it around your neck like a canoe paddle. You hold it close to your body. You hold it close to your heart."
Yeah.
And that resonated with me.
Okay.
And then I had a knee injury where I had to sit down for a while.
Okay.
And I realized this is where it's at.
Sure.
I mean, in the studio you sit out.
Yes.
Or at least I do. Most guitar players do.
Yes.
It's a proper way to approach the instrument.
Yep.
And even years later, I became friends with B.B. King. And he had a knee operation. And we did a Showtime special out of the China Club in L.A. And before the show, he said, "Skunk, if I had only known how good it is to sit down," because now he had to, because he was recovering from knee surgery, "I would have done this from the beginning." I said, "Yeah, I'm telling you, told you before, you know, this is the way to do it. This is the way to play the instrument."
Sure. Well, you know, when I watch videos of you playing live, it seems very compelling to keep eyes on you, because it just seems like you're emanating. It all resonates from you. What's going on stage?
Well, you're very kind. I mean, I was not one for trampolines and running around, and I just wasn't my thing. I had a lot of energy, but it just didn't make sense to me. I took some grief for it in the beginning.
Did you?
You know, people said that's not rock and roll is supposed to be, and I'm saying, well, who wrote the rules, number one? And number two, I want to play at my best.
Yeah.
And I play at my best when I'm sitting down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wearing headphones, whether I'm in the studio or I'm in front of 50,000 people.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that the Guitar Player magazine interviewed you a few times early on, but did you ever write a column for Guitar Player?
Yes. It was called The Eclectic Electric.
Okay. That's right. That's right. And you had all kinds of crazy guitars.
Well, I had a number of instruments, especially being a kid growing up in Mexico. I mean, you could buy a Fender Stratocaster at Manny's in 1963 for $265 with a case.
Wow.
In Mexico City, it was almost $800.
Damn.
So I certainly had gotten comfortable with playing some of the Japanese guitars.
Taiskos and Echo and all that.
St. George.
Yeah.
And Echo is Italian.
Okay.
And the only reason I know that is when Dave Schechter and I had the guitar shop in Boston. We would get shipments from Echo with different nameplates. One said Echo, one said Vox.
Okay.
And if people needed more Vox inventory, I would just put the Vox on them because they were OEMing guitars for Vox.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was playing some of those Italian guitars were great. And the Hagstroms, the Sparkle Top guitars with them, they were fantastic guitars. They sounded great, played great.
Yeah.
So I was a fan of that kind of guitar. Big fan of Harmony. Mm-hmm. Big fan of Dan Electro.
Sure.
National, Valco.
Yeah.
All of those guitars I liked.
Sure.
So I would review them and use them on gigs.
Yeah, yeah.
And people, because other people were like sweating to buy a Les Paul custom.
Sure, sure.
I'm thinking, okay, well, that's nice. But
yeah, was it a lot of work to get them in tune?
Sometimes. The Harmony guitars that were coming out of Sears were great guitars. I still have a few.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
They play great.
Yeah. What does your collection look like now?
Well, I thinned it down a lot. Some years ago, John Entwistle and I were out having dinner. And I said, John, how many guitars do you have? He said, I got about 400. He said, how many do you have? I said, well, I got about 150, maybe 175. And I looked at him, I said, you know, we're assholes. We have all these beautiful instruments sitting in cases that nobody's playing.
Yeah.
We are going to go to hell for this. So we decided to get rid of everything.
Yeah.
So now I have maybe 30 guitars. Most of them I use for sessions and stuff.
Sure.
And a couple of collectibles, you know, a couple of the old beat up guitars I just love hanging around, you know.
Yeah. The collectibles like Arch Tops or what are we talking?
Well, I have a couple of original D'Angelico.
Do you really? Oh, right on.
I've got a beautiful Super 400.
Yeah.
That the guys at the Gibson Custom Shop made for me.
Oh, fantastic.
I have a Harmony Arch Top. It sounds great.
Okay.
I had to do, this was years ago in Nashville. I got a call from a gentleman who said, I needed to play kind of like a Django Reinhardt style, you know, kind of gypsy guitar. And the tone for that really comes from Arch Top.
Yep.
And I took this cheap Harmony in, and it sounded great. Very lively, very expressive, very dynamic. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the guitar sold originally for $65.
Yeah, no kidding.
It had binding. Yeah. Well, ooh.
What about amps? Do you have amps at home?
I do.
Anything in particular? Fender, all Fenders or a variety?
A lot of Roland because I've been working with Roland for 52 years.
Okay.
And I've helped design amplifiers for them.
Like the JC-120s and stuff?
The JC-120 was designed by Mark Taruta and his team.
Okay.
But the Blues Cube artist and the Blues Cube stage series, I spent a lot of time in Hamamatsu.
Okay.
Working on those instruments. Some work on their acoustic guitar amplifiers.
Sure.
And yeah, a couple of other projects. Yeah.
Right.
But I have a collection of amps too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if I'm going to go down to Huntington Beach and play with Dean Torrance from Jan and Dean.
Yeah, of course.
And the Surf City All-Stars.
Yeah.
I'm taking my white Jazzmaster that Fender built for me years ago.
Okay.
And my Fender Reverb unit.
Uh-huh.
And my dual Showman amp.
Okay. Wow, it's going to be loud.
And so I'm, that, but that's the sound.
Yes, it is.
That is it.
Yeah. And I'm, certainly you're playing surf music, but are you listening to surf music as well?
I started to. There's a couple of people have turned me on to some stuff.
Yeah.
And it's become a boutique genre, but there are a lot of people that are exploring it. I think because the driving nature of the guitar playing in surf music,
yeah,
is compelling.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's all the good parts.
It's all eighth notes.
Yeah.
So, with lots of reverb.
Yep. And anybody in particular listening to?
Not that I can recall.
Okay.
But I'm starting to go out and search it.
Yeah.
Doesn't do it.
You recorded an album with Glenn Campbell at one point. Had you met Glenn Campbell before that?
Yeah. He was did a lot of studio work in L.A.
Okay.
Yeah, a good player.
Did you bring Michael McDonald into the Doobies? Was that your doing?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And basically, I mean, it turned the Doobies from a rock act, a normal everyday rock act, into something that was more than that, almost, you know, not quite as complex as Steely Dan, but pretty damn complex.
That was kind of in the back of my mind.
Okay.
And it's like, I guess Pat Simmons said, I upped their game.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I guess that's the way to put it. But those guys were and are extremely talented musicians who probably were not operating at their peak performance.
Sure.
And capabilities. So whatever I brought, there was no huffing and puffing.
Yeah.
And everybody was and still is fine musicians.
Sure, sure, sure.
And the band, it definitely morphed. Some bands can do that. Some bands can't.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac is a perfect example of
sure.
morphing and people accepting it.
Yeah.
So it's doable.
Did you play pedal steel with the Doobies as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you have a pedal steel at home now?
Oh, I always do, yeah.
Yeah. What type of pedal steel?
Showbud.
Okay.
Super Pro. Yeah. I've got a few of them, yeah.
And how many knee levers and how many foot levers?
8 pedals, 4 knee levers, 2 up levers.
Wow. That is a lot of math right there. And oh my god. I don't want to change subject too much. This is a guitar podcast, but how'd you end up working with the government? You recorded a record that was released, was it in Russia or was it East Berlin that helped bring down the wall?
Well, let's see. You asked me like 3 questions.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
No, I just want to make sure I answer each one.
Yeah.
And the first one was,
how'd you end up working with the government?
Well, it'd be in my book, which is almost finished, actually. Okay. But I came up with a way to modify a naval air defense, fleet defense system.
Wow.
To do missile defense.
Oh, man.
And matching up certain radars and certain things that, and wrote a paper and they called me in.
Wow.
And as far as Russia was concerned, and that will be in my book too, is I smuggled some recording gear into Russia.
Wow.
When Bill Graham put together a tour,
uh-huh,
or a single show actually, in Moscow, 6 bands, Doobies, Bonnie Raitt,
yeah,
Carl Santana, Power Power.
Yeah.
And when I went over there, I brought with me some gear and...
And you left it accidentally. Gave it a,
I left a lot of stuff there accidentally.
Very good. And did you record a record that was released over there?
No. No, but there was... I should get this lady's her name right. But there was an album that was recorded over there called Red Wave.
Okay.
Which was really the first recordings that had been available in the West of what was going on in the rock scene in Russia.
Okay. Was Jack Douglas involved in that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Though your first thing you mentioned about working with the government, with working with radar and stuff, had you been, was that stuff in your, something that you were pursuing while you were playing music?
Not really, but because of all the consulting work that I was doing with Fender and Akai,
okay,
and Roland, I was trying to gain as much knowledge as I could about the transition from analog to digital.
Sure.
And I read every defense publication there was.
Oh, really? Damn.
And for that, I was getting a lot of information that just sort of percolated.
Yeah. What do you think of you know, the recent stuff about aliens and stuff like that? Do you pay attention to any of that kind of stuff?
Well, I pay attention to everything.
Okay.
As far as getting into discussions about aliens, and I should not probably comment on that.
Okay. Fair enough.
But what I will comment on is there were a lot of technologies that were developed by the Germans in World War II. Are you familiar with Foo Fighters?
Sure.
Okay, well, that phenomenon is when you have hundreds of B-17 and B-24 pilots seeing that, that's for real.
Yeah.
When you see the levels of technology that the Germans had reached, especially in aeronautics.
Yeah.
There's even some evidence, according to Nick Cook, the former senior aviation editor for Jane's Defense Weekly, who wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, that the Germans had invented an anti-gravity propulsion system.
Wow.
Called Die Glocke.
Yeah.
And there was mounting evidence. People say that, nah, it never happened. Nick did his homework.
Yeah.
So many of the things that I think people see maybe future technologies that are being leveraged now.
Yeah.
Highly classified.
Sure. The stuff we see over San Diego and stuff like that.
And again, I really can't comment on that.
Okay.
But I'm just saying that I would posit to a number of people that's a good place to start.
Sure. All your consulting work and all this work that you're doing, how did you have time to be playing guitar? I mean, you had to play guitar to be consulting with Fender and Gibson and stuff, and Roland for that matter. But like, it just sounds so daunting, what you were doing at that time.
You know, I never really thought much about it. Probably if I had, I probably would have, like, you know, seized up. To me, everything is kind of related. I mean, I use this phrase over and over, but a radar is just an electric guitar on steroids.
Okay.
It's the same physics, same properties, electromagnetism.
Yeah.
It wasn't like what I'm doing is that separated. To me, there's a lot of commonality. At the very least, tangential.
What was your major at BU?
Public communications. It was journalism and sound for video.
Okay.
Because I hated the way that music sounded on television. And I asked them if I could, obviously I might have to take journalism courses because that's what my dad wanted me to do.
Okay.
But I had asked them if I could go down a path that would incorporate things that were relevant to sound for their video.
Okay. Was it the recording itself, or was it the unit, you know, the device? Was it the TV speakers? Did you improve the TV speakers, or did you improve the recording techniques?
I did build a kind of a cheesy mono television with really nice speakers.
Okay.
And equalization.
Okay.
And so that told me that there was hope.
Yeah.
Then the next question was, okay, on the front end, where the music was being recorded, what is the level of technology there? And in many cases, it was very good. Mm-hmm. High quality microphones.
Yeah.
The best recording equipment possible.
Sure.
It just wasn't making it out of the box.
Yeah.
So, something I spent a lot of time with.
Were you playing guitar, or were you working on cars and stuff to kind of like give yourself some freedom from all this tech work that you were doing?
Well, by that time, I wasn't working on cars very much at all.
Okay.
But still, I didn't in my mind differentiate.
Sure.
To me, it was all the same. If I would be working on maybe improving the routing in an old recording console and then discover, oh, this equalization circuit,
yeah,
this is very cool. What if I built one and built it into a box and plugged my guitar into it? What could I do?
Sure, sure. And are you an avid reader? You must be.
Very much so.
Yeah. Any, like, a book a day or a book a week? Or?
Probably don't read as many books as I should. Mostly what I read are technical journals. Mm-hmm. I mean, every week I read Aviation Week,
okay,
Defense Weekly, Foreign Affairs Quarterly, Foreign Policy Review.
Oh, wow.
National Defense.
Sure.
And then, of course, Guitar Player Magazine, Vintage Guitar.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I read pretty much current stuff.
Is there anything you do to relax out, outside of music and all these books and stuff?
No, because again, I love playing the guitar.
Sure, sure, sure.
And I love reading.
Yeah.
And I love, osmosing information.
Yeah.
So I'm having fun all the time.
You live in LA right now, or where do you live?
I do.
I live in
Los Angeles.
Yeah. How close are you to the beach?
With no traffic?
Yeah, well, I don't think that exists.
There are times, yeah. Okay. I mean, it's probably a third of the day where you could, half hour,
okay,
35 minutes maybe.
Sure.
Heading down the 405 out of Santa Monica.
Yeah. Do you go to clubs very often?
I used to. I haven't been doing it very much.
Uh-huh.
Because I've been out playing with different folks.
Sure.
And my own band.
Uh-huh.
And so I really haven't had much time.
Yeah. And any plans for a second solo album?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been thinking about it because I've been hanging out with different players and stuff and been talking about what the future might bring.
Sure.
And it would be fun to do another record, I think.
Oh, of course it would. Do you ever go down and play at the Baked Potato?
Yeah, I've played there before, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Spud. Yep, great place.
Do you run into people like Joe Bonamassa or any of those guys?
I just saw him about a month ago. We did a birthday party for Billy Gibbons.
Okay.
At the Troubadour, and we got a chance to hang out.
Oh, that's great.
I've known him for some years.
Uh-huh.
Very, very great. Very cool guy.
Oh, of course. Not unlike yourself. You know what? It's been an honor to speak with you. I really appreciate all your time. And
thank you, sir.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I hope I get an opportunity to meet you in person at some point here.
I look forward to it.
Okay, very good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, talk to you later.
Take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com, and I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend, and I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.